You're listening to Bob, Dave, and Moore.
Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
The 5 o'clock refresh is brought to you by Frost Brewed Coors Light, made to chill. It is Bob, Dave, and Moore here on 710 ESPN Seattle. Always a pleasure to speak with this guy, a guy who's had plenty of experience managing salary caps, being in the front office of the Green Bay Packers. Now he's part of Monday Morning Quarterback. Andrew Brandt is here. Andrew, how are you, sir?
Doing well, guys. Hope you're doing well. It's a busy time for me, as always, when there are no games going on whatsoever.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, you know, as much as the Hall of Fame game has been eliminated, it looks like everything else is still on schedule. So hopefully it remains that way. We spent a lot of time on this show talking about Major League Baseball and the back and forth public negotiations, and they just seemed incredibly tone deaf. They didn't even come to an agreement. The owners implemented this 60-game schedule, so we'll see if there's going to be a work stoppage. But the NFL is due to lose a lot of money with no fans in the stands, and we keep hearing about the salary cap going down next year and the possibility of negotiating pay cuts at the NFL level because of the pandemic. Do you see that being a reality?
Yeah, I've also been following baseball pretty closely, and what's happened is everyone thinks it's about the virus. No, it's about the money, because business really is what's at stake with all of this, and that's why, as I've been writing about, the clear thing to do for the complete health and safety of the product, players at all sports, is to not play. I mean, if you're really concerned about the health and safety of the people, then the best thing is just don't play this year. But, of course, it's all about the business. I think we're adult enough to understand that. So this is about business of sports. And baseball owners, we're going to have the players share their pain. They're doing less than half a season. They're doing no fans. It's going to be a massive income drop for them, and they're going to have players share their pain. And ultimately, the players really couldn't agree what to share, so it was imposed upon them. Football's going to have this. Now, not to the extent, because we won't have 60 games versus 160, and we won't have no fans whatsoever, I don't think. But football is going to have to go to the union and do this as well. As you mentioned, no union wants to go into the subsequent year with a lower cap than the previous year. So I think both sides want to get ahead of that.
Andrew, how much do you think with baseball that this is going to affect labor peace? How bad is it going to get going forward? And is the NFL possibly, I know they just signed a big deal, but are they possibly also going to have labor strife because of this season upcoming the way you see it?
Well, I think the baseball thing was part of exactly what you're talking about. The players didn't want to give away anything that could be used as another chip in the big negotiation, which is going to be in 18 months for the new CBA. So the players didn't want to say give up some kind of expanded playoffs or give up the right to sue, because you have all this coming up and they want to hold that powder dry. And the football situation, as you noted, I mean, at the very start of the pandemic, like the day that it hit, the owners and players signed an 11-year deal. And they probably thought they wouldn't be negotiating with each other for 10 years. And here they are. They're going to have to. Now, it's not going to be anything major like a new CBA, but it's going to be, as I said, about diminution of revenues in 2020. Okay, what are we going to do about that? Because players can't say go pound salt, because you want to pound salt, okay, your cap's going from 200 in 2020 to 170 in 2021. Deal with that.
Andrew, do you think that even though fans have been turned off by all the negotiations, that the ratings will be through the roof, the TV ratings?
I do, at least for a while. I don't, you know, obviously we're sports starved, and this no fan thing is going to be intriguing. That may drop off. I don't know. I mean, the advantage that hockey and basketball have is they're short. You know, there's 2 months, and they'll get it done, and everyone will be excited, and they'll go away again. Baseball, you know, we'll see. We'll see how long the excitement lasts, but there'll be pennant races, and then we get to the monolith, the NFL. No fans, no fans, whatever. Yes, ratings will be through the roof for the NFL.
What do you think of the idea? We've heard, you know, Joe Buck talk about them piping in sound if there are no people in the stands, and I hate that idea. I've got to be honest. I think it's lame. I think it'd be cool if we're just talking about one season. It would be really cool for fans to hear the game in a way they've never heard it before, and that would be those hits that take place that you don't hear, and maybe some of the conversation. Yeah, I know curse words could be there, but you know, maybe you're hearing calls and just hearing conversations you otherwise wouldn't. What do you think of that, and would that be a detriment? Do you think that would be appealing to fans, piping in sound? What's your take on that?
Well, I think what you talked about is definitely appealing to fans in terms of the access to player conversation, coaching conversation especially, coaches yelling out plays, especially in basketball. The basketball idea of listening in on all that conversation I think is really appealing. It's what fans really want, actually, that they can never get in a crowded arena. In terms of outdoor sports, it's going to be still harder to hear, but I don't know the answer to that. I think that it's going to take a lot of getting used to no sound in the stadiums. And maybe the getting used to it will be a good thing. Maybe the getting used to it will be a bad thing. But I have talked to executives, not coaches, but team executives that are having their coaches figure out how to have the quarterback not be so loud with the calls in an empty stadium so that fans, i.e. teams watching the games, don't pick up on it. So there are a lot of strategy going on here too.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, Andrew, because, you know, playing in front of a crowd, I know defensively you had to use hand signals because it was so loud, and now you might be using hand signals because it's so quiet, you know, because, you know, you don't want them hearing the calls. I saw you with Pat McAfee and thought it was interesting. You were talking about some of the high-priced veterans with this going with the salary cap possibly going down. That's probably not a place that you want to be if you're a guy in his seventh, eighth year and you've got a rich contract. Do you think we're going to see a spate of either those guys getting cut or some serious renegotiations of contracts?
I do. I think it goes back to what I'm saying, that if they're going to smooth up the cap to 2021, so you have a cap in 2021 that's higher than 2020, you're going to have to bring down 2020 cap. And people say, well, it was already said and they got contracts. Well, anyone listening that follows the business of football knows football contracts are kind of worth the paper they're written on, except for the elite players. So you could have veterans that make $5, $6, $8, $10 million one day, and the next day they're making zero. Or they're making $1 million with the threat of a pay cut or release. So I can see a lot of that going on. This really gets back to the business of football being stalled, guys, because Christian McCaffrey, I just named the list of extensions done in 2020. I mean, that's it. That's it. Yeah. So people are asking me about Prescott and Mahomes and Deshaun Watson. I mean, none of it. No. No team is going to do these deals now. And there's going to be a lot more deletions than additions. So it's really a hard time right now to be an agent or a player.
Hey, Andrew, I've been thinking a lot lately about the NFL and how they've managed to navigate these waters fairly well, or really well, I guess, with the free agency that they went through. Then they held the draft. And now they're just going headlong into the planning the training camps as scheduled. And then I read your story at SI.com, the headline, "If health was a top priority, NFL wouldn't play in 2020. And that's what I've been wondering. I mean, they're like a locomotive just going down the track. And yet we understand it's a business, but some of the things that you had in your story just really struck home with me. The acts of blocking and tackling would seem to involve a lot of droplet exchange. Another passage from your story, all the protocols in the world don't answer how to practice and play a game, that is inherently violent and diametrically opposed to social distancing. So I just wonder how, I mean, everything's just going along swimmingly right now, but when we find out more and more players testing positive for the virus, I just wonder if they're going to be stopped in their tracks at some point.
Yeah, I was trying to think of the word that's the opposite of social distancing, and I thought about intimacy, but it sounded too sensual. I don't know what that word is, but, you know, the act of football, as you guys know, is extreme pressure at extremely close distance, and that's droplet exchange. So, you know, here's the thing. Now, you know, we've got Zeke Elliott. I just think we're being a little cavalier, certainly the NFL is, about full speed ahead. Because, and part of it, I think, is because these guys are young, strong, and healthy. But as I said in my column for Sports Illustrated, I listened into a conference call with Tom Mayer, who's the NFLPA doc, and he's worried. Now, he's on the player side, and he's like, we got three categories here that haven't done well with the virus. African-American, high BMIs, and sleep apnea. And those are part of our population. I don't know how much of our population, but a good part. That's a problem. And the second part I mentioned was the Von Miller story. You know, I read a lot of, you do, we all do read a lot of NFL stories, media. That's one that just stopped me in my tracks. Von Miller, you know, a super specimen, is saying that 3-4 weeks after recovering from the virus, he's having some issues working out. He's having some windedness, some lung capacity. I'm like, oh my God. Now that's Von Miller. So just think about, we can't really say that, okay, you know, Zeke Elliott, if he got the virus, but if he got it in October, he'd be fine in November. We just don't know that right now.
Well, and then you probably heard the news today, Malcolm Jenkins telling CNN that he doesn't think football is an essential business and that he doesn't feel like the risk is worth it to play. Do you think we're going to see more players opting out like him?
Yeah, I mean, I've had players reach out to me about that question of opting out. Obviously, players can opt out. The real question everyone has is, can they get paid to opt out? And I think that's going to be touchy. I bring up the idea of a TUE, which is a therapeutic use exemption. You sort of have to have a doctor's note that you've got one of these comorbidities, that you've got a sick relative at home, that you've got an elderly relative at home, and maybe you can get paid. But again, certainly players are going to want to opt out. Whether they get paid or not is a deeper question, because if there's some blanket statement, yeah, you get paid, then everyone's going to opt out. Yeah, why not sit home and get paid?
And if they do opt out, I would assume if they're getting paid, that does count as service time. So if they've got 1 year left on their deal, would that in turn serve as a year served and they become free agents? Or how do you think that works?
Yes, if they're paid. But my sense is, top of my head, they won't get paid. Their contract will toll, meaning it's suspended. So they come back in 2021. They had 2 years left. They have 2 years left. They had 1 year left. They have 1 year left. It's the same money. And I just don't think we're going to be in a position of paying players who opt out.
Andrew, you know, you mentioned Von Miller is the one that scared you. I think the one that scared me was Tony Boselli, who's probably 10 years younger than me and in better shape. And, yeah, you know, there was a story on ESPN where it just, I mean, he's a Hall of Fame offensive tackle and he's in great shape and it just wiped him out. But as far as like legally, I guess the NFL's probably scrambling for waivers and things like that. I mean, that's got to be a big part of what they're going through right now, too. I've seen, you know, like, I guess there are rallies and things like that where you have to sign a waiver. But, you know, there could be a lot of potential for lawsuits, I would think, in the NFL if they're going to have this. And, you know, you're going to have fans come in or even the players as well.
Yeah. The other thing is waivers. You know, I'm a lawyer, and I, you know, was at the Packers 10 years, and if I was in that job, I'd be thinking about waivers. Exactly what I just talked about. You know, what if Von Miller, someone like him, never recovers? What if a player goes home and, you know, this isn't, they're not going to be in the bubble like the NFL. So a player goes home, infects an older relative, something, God forbid, drastic happens. Liability. Now, the union's going to get involved and buck up against any waivers, but these things, you know, when I was managing an NFL team, I worried about hips and shoulders and knees, not this.
Yeah, Andrew, you mentioned your 10 years with the Packers. When you were an executive there, what kind of, could you take us inside on what the conversations are probably like between GM and executives about Jadeveon Clowney right now?
Yeah, what's his agent looking for? Why hasn't he signed? You know, usually when a player doesn't sign, it's a couple things. One, something's out there that is not good about the player that insiders are starting to hear about. But number two, there seems to be a disconnect between the marketplace and what the agent and player want. So it'd be that kind of discussion and where the market might go for him. Obviously, we have a unique market right now. And someone that can come in and rush the passer at a moment's notice, so probably not someone you're worried about spending a lot of time in camp having to sign right away, and has a history of waiting till the last minute. So kind of par for the course. I think people know what is there, and if there's a team interested, you know, if I was interested, I'd be the one continually touching base with the agent, just monitoring the situation. Maybe there'd be 2-minute phone calls. Maybe there'd be 5-minute phone calls, but just checking in.
Andrew, we heard from the Cardinals owner in baseball, Bill DeWitt Jr., saying that, you know, hey, this, you know, owning a team isn't really profitable, and, you know, trying to make the case that, you know, all the money goes back into the organization. I know there are different business models in baseball versus football, but how much of a hit, how many of these owners, if any, in either sport, do you think are truly struggling in a season with no revenue in terms of fans coming in? Right now, baseball's losing games. The NFL has not yet, but they're not going to have full stadiums. So how legit is that, you know, that statement that, you know, it's really, really not that profitable, but then you see the value of these organizations all in the billions?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I'm trying to not be one of these bash the billionaires, but there are operating revenue issues right now with the virus. There's no question about that. And I know what Rob Manfred was dealing with. He was dealing with small market owners who, and when they look at their balance sheet, they're kind of better off not playing this year than paying whatever salaries they're going to pay, 60 games of salaries with no fans. So he was bumping up against that, and that's a tough thing to do. Of course, the Dodgers and Yankees and Red Sox wanted to play, and Cubs, but maybe a lot of teams didn't. So he was trying to save baseball but also deal with ownership that was better off not playing. And all these teams will suffer losses on the short term. But as you said, this is where you lose the empathy, right? Because every professional sports owner has an increasing asset value, every one of them. These baseball teams, football teams, basketball teams, not a one is losing franchise value right now. Now they're losing operating revenue, but they're not losing value. So these owners that cry poverty, sure, you know, maybe they're having a bad year, but they bought the team for $500 million and they're going to sell for $3 billion in a few years. So that's where they are.
Andrew Brandt of Monday Morning Quarterback has been our guest here. Andrew, always good to talk to you. Thanks so much for cutting out time for us. Stay safe out there, and we look forward to talking to you soon.
Same, guys. Take care.
There you go. Good stuff from Andrew Brandt. A reminder, you can listen to our show via the 710 Sports app. It's powered by Dubin Law Group. It's free. You can just download it, listen to the show live, walk around in the sunshine, check out the show, or you can listen to podcasts, text in, all that's at your fingertips with the app. Coming up, KJ Wright disagrees with Football Outsiders' choice of the 2013 Seahawks as the team of the decade. He thinks it was another Seahawks team. We'll let you hear why that is coming up with Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio. Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
Hey, if you guys have smart speakers in your homes, whether it's Alexa, Google, whatever it is, just tell it to play 710 ESPN Seattle or 710 AM and it becomes a radio right there for you. You don't miss a thing. You don't want to miss a thing because then you miss a whole bunch. We talked about KJ Wright disagreeing with what Football Outsiders deemed the team of the decade, which was the 2013 version of the Seattle Seahawks. They were number one. The 2010 Patriots were number two. The 2015 Seahawks were number three. The 2012 Seahawks were four. And the 2019 Ravens were number five. So there's your top five. KJ Wright, who did a thing on Instagram Live with our guy G Scott, cut number eight, said he actually feels like the 2014 Seahawks team was the best of all of them.
Now, see, I'm going 2014 because of pretty much your same exact argument. You had Michael Bennett and Cliff Averill on the bench a good majority of the game. Now, when in 2014,
that was in 2013.
Yeah, 2013. Okay. Now, 2014, these two dudes were starting, and Mike B was just causing havoc.
Okay.
Cliff was causing havoc.
He was.
And then you got the surrounding cast. You got the Cliffs. You got the Bobbies, the KJs, who had an extra year of just confidence, of just chemistry.
Okay.
And it was just that 2014 team did, hands down, one of probably the most impressive things I've ever seen. And that was beat the Green Bay Packers in the NFC Championship in those conditions. No other team in the NFL history could have did that.
Did you see you went third person there? The Bobbies, the KJs. Something
okay.
About
KJ can do that.
Yeah, I was just going to say something about it coming out of KJ's mouth just makes it seem okay. He's just such a good dude. But what do you think of that? I mean, the 13 Seahawks, they win, obviously, the Super Bowl. They are as dominant as they've ever looked. But he does have a point about Michael Bennett and Averill and how their roles increased. Now, obviously, the season didn't end the way we all wanted it to. We don't need to relive that. But just the team overall, and it was one of many years in a row. I believe it was four seasons in a row where they led the league in points allowed as a defense, which to me should be the ultimate measure. But what do you think?
Well, I think I can see it from KJ's point of view. It's interesting. I was watching Super Bowl 49 the other day, and you know, Brady, and they had guys mic'd up, but you know, a lot of the players are on the sidelines were going, "Man, these guys are so good." You know, and on defense, they really were. But I'm going through looking at, first of all, they were 12-4 that year. They lost 30-21 at San Diego. I don't know if you remember. That's the Bruce
Super
Snow
hot. Game. It was a very hot day, wasn't it?
It was really hot, and that was the one where I think Bruce hit Phillip Rivers going out of bounds. They lost to Dallas at home somehow. At St. Louis, they lost by 2 points, and then they lost to Kansas City. But, man, I'm looking at I can see why KJ says that. Because number one, yards per game, they were number one in the NFL defensively. 267 yards they gave up. Passing, they were number one. They gave up only 185 yards. Rushing, they were number three. They only gave up 81 yards, and that's what I think Tampa gave up this last year, and they were number one. And then, of course, the 15.9 points per game. I mean, I think he makes a good point there that, first of all, your defense is just rock solid. All of those numbers. I think they were fourth or fifth in turnover ratio. They were plus nine. But still, you know, those games, they lost, you know, there weren't the 9-point loss to San Diego. I mean, at the time, that was the Chargers. You know, that was probably the worst one. But their
defense Cowboy game
was so
dominant. Wasn't the Cowboy game, wasn't that the game Percy Harvin refused to go into the game? Like, that was
sure
the final straw?
Yep, sure is. Yep, and then he got traded, and, yeah, the news broke, and Groz went to a casino, and the rest is history.
just left me sitting there. Yep, I remember that. Yeah, so
I remember asking Groz about that because I thought, man, did that really happen? And Groz just went, "Yep, it did."
gotta beat traffic.
that was interesting.
You know, I'll give KJ his due because he played on that team, but boy, from outside looking in, it's hard to think that the 2014 team was better than the 2013 team, especially when the way you capped it off, beating Denver by 35 points, holding that offensive juggernaut to 8 points in the biggest game of all. And then also, that year, for everybody who thinks I'm pessimistic, and that's probably every single listener, I remember at the beginning of that year, Dave, maybe you'll remember this, Bob, maybe you will too, or maybe not. Maybe you'll think I'm just full of it. But I thought they might go unbeaten that year. And I remember being really bummed out when they lost at Indianapolis because I thought, oh, okay, I'm wrong again. But they started out 4-0, and then even after losing at Indianapolis, they won 7 in a row. They were 11-1 at one point. Now they ended up a 2-2 finish to go 13-3. But I just thought that team was much more solid than at least a little bit more solid, that you would call them the best team of the decade, the way they finished it off. And if you consider, I mean, come on, they were lucky to beat Green Bay in the NFC Championship game, weren't they?
Oh, yeah. Four interceptions. I mean, that's a lot to overcome.
Yeah,
so you could say that's what makes them great. I mean, you could say, like KJ said, no other team could have come back from that. I mean, that is the greatest comeback. I remember everybody was in tears afterwards. I mean, it was just amazing. The other thing I'd say about that is the 13 team, they had a good offense, but they weren't, you know, they weren't top 10. They were the 18th as far as yards go, 18th offense in 2013. In 2014, they were top 10. They were number 9. So they were a little bit better offensively, and I think you could argue that they were, other than the takeaways, they were pretty squared away on defense as well.
Yeah, one of the things, sorry, Bob, I mean, that San Diego game, and we all remember that game because it was just so super hot and everybody cramping up. And the other thing about it, it was a 9-point loss, and I think that was the first time in, I don't know, some like 30 or 40 or 50-game stretch where they finally lost a game by more than one score. You remember that consistency record they had? It was just incredible. Even when they lost, they would only lose by one score.
Yeah, that's right. It was an incredible team. I don't think KJ's wrong. It didn't end the right way, but, you know, coming back in that Packer game, as he said, you know, they were the only team in history that could have done it. I don't know about that, but they did overcome a terrible day. I'm looking at the box score from that day, and it wasn't a great day for Aaron Rodgers either, by the way. Aaron Rodgers in that game went 19 of 34 for 178 yards, a touchdown, and 2 picks. Russell Wilson, 14 of 29, 209 yards, 1 touchdown, 4 interceptions. He had a horrible day. Every one of his interceptions were targeted for Jermaine Kearse, who had 1 catch. And the only one that mattered, 1 for 35 yards and a touchdown. He was targeted 6 times and had 1 catch that day, but it was the one that mattered most. So it was just, you look at that box score and go, ugh. I mean, outside, Lynch had a huge day, 157 yards and a touchdown. But the fact that they pulled it out on a day, which you could have argued was one of the worst for Russell Wilson, is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, well, that was amazing. And remember, Kearse, him. I mean, for him to go back, for Russell Wilson to go back to Jermaine Kearse after that kind of day, I mean, and that's where I think a lot of Russell's greatness lies, in that, you know, he trusts his teammates. And so, you know, throwing that, I mean, if that gets tipped away or gets picked off, God forbid, I mean, everybody's going to say, you know, what are you doing? Why in the world would you throw, you know, a 5th interception to Jermaine Kearse, and he just believed in him. But, you know, whenever you go back and you think about, number one, how did Russell not get a concussion in that game? And the Stecker theory, by the way, Brent Stecker, 710sports.com, says that he believes that a part of the first part of it, of all the picks and everything, was because he was concussed. And then he suddenly became unconcussed and then went off at the end.
But I like that stuff.
I always say I played some of my best games concussed. So maybe the concussion actually helped him later on. But no, you know, there was that. There, I mean, of course, the onside kick I mean, that's a huge, I mean, what, 18% of those or something get recovered, 15% maybe? And then, you know, what about the two-point conversion to Luke Wilson where Russ had to just chuck it all the way back across the field? And I think, did Luke kind of double clutch it, like it bounced off his hands or something? I'm trying to remember the two-point conversion to send it into overtime.
I can't. Everything about that game was so improbable. It was just so weird. Yeah. What a weird game. And for them to make it to the Super Bowl, then they get there, they look like they're going to rout the Patriots. They were up by 10 points. They were up by 10 points. And, you know, we focus on the final play. That defense coughed up a 10-point lead in that game when they shut down the Patriots' running game. I think LeGarrette Blount had like 40 yards on the day, and Brady threw a couple of picks. And, yeah, it was just it was just a weird last two games of that season, without question.
Yeah.
All right, coming up, the 60-game baseball season raises a lot of questions as to what we should expect this year. ESPN had a panel of their experts weigh in with some thoughts. We'll talk about that next year with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and Moore.
Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
With baseball getting set to embark on a 60-game season, a lot of people talking about what the records may look like. Will anything be considered a record? ESPN went through an interesting exercise. They took their baseball experts, Bradford Doolittle, David Schoenfeld, and Sam Miller, and asked them a few questions about, you know, this 60-game season, like how many wins is the team with the best record likely to have in a 60-game season? And they each gave their answers, and they were both around, or all three of them were in the 41, 43, 42 game. They all kind of were in that area. So 40-some games out of 60, they expect that to be the best record in baseball. They were also asked how many wins might it take to make the playoffs. They're all kind of in the same neighborhood, 33 win team, 32, 28, 31, and 29, kind of what they're looking at. When you guys look at this season, is there anything you would be, the only thing you could consider a record, I guess, would be a hitting streak, right? If somebody hits in 57 straight games, will that count? The record's 56. So does that count, or do you have to go? Because you're just talking about the length of that streak. Doesn't mean it has to go through the entire season. Doesn't matter where that streak takes place. Outside of that, I'm not sure what record you could look at as legit. And there might even be people that say, yeah, this guy hit for 57 straight games, but it was a 60-game season. I don't know that argument would hold water personally, but still 57 in a row.
I don't know. Wouldn't it be almost more impressive that, like, you have to get on it, like, right away? A lot of times, you know, guys get warm up, and you're basically talking about a third of the season, you know, that close to that. And, you know, maybe you go through a slump. I mean, there's no room for slump in a 60-game season, right, if you're going to get that record. I think that's a good one. I mean, yeah, it's not very inspiring, though, to see these numbers like, oh, our team is going to make it to the playoffs if they win 41 games.
No, so that could be the best record, you know, in the league.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, and it also kind of makes me think about last year when they were 13-2, and if the Mariners were able to get off on a crazy start like that, and just how different teams are going to be, you know, as far as, you know, what if guys test positive and get sick? What if Trout, you know, isn't a player like that, or maybe a team loses a couple of guys like that? You know, it could be kind of up for grabs.
Yeah, I got a kick out of it yesterday. One of the listeners texted in and wondered about Kyle Seager, if that maybe Kyle Seager is typically a slow starter. Do you think that he's going to be a slow starter in July, or do you think he'll be hot in July like he typically is when he slumps in April and May? I mean, it was just kind of a – I mean, I know he was kind of poking fun there, but maybe Seager will be hot right away because it'll be hotter weather. I don't know. I'm just – everything is just so up in the air, and it's just hard to figure out. I was looking at that same story that you're talking about, Bob, and the leading home run guy is probably going to have 18.5 homers. So, and we're used to just – it's just weird to think that, yeah, your home run winner is going to have 18 or 19 homers, and – the most wins for a starter. I know no one cares about wins for a starter that much anymore. I still like seeing 20 wins for a starter, though, during a typical season. And one of the writers was thinking that six wins might be the number one mark, and you can see why. Some of the managers are going to have six-man rotations, and I mean, these guys, you know, only going to be pitching three or four innings apiece, you know, early on anyway.
Yeah, Doolittle predicted, as far as that goes, I predict a 19-way tie with six wins leading the majors. So you got 19 different pitchers with six wins. They asked, like, what will be the Major League Baseball leading WAR number? Schoenfeld said, probably whatever Mike Trout puts up. You know, and others, you know, going into the semantics of it, saying, you know, 5.1, it'll either be Trout or some pretty good defender. You know, they're asking about, again, records that could be broken. There, legitimately, there could be nothing that realistically could be broken outside of, again, DiMaggio's 56-game hitting streak.
Yeah, Dave, so, we talked about it yesterday, but they've got a line on the Mariners, or all the teams, over-unders on win totals, and they've got the Mariners at 25.5 in a 60-game season.
Ooh, 25.5?
Mm-hmm.
That seems like a lot. Are you thinking under?
I don't know what I was thinking. I was hoping. Well,
you're thinking the over, Jim. Jim wrote a very positive, optimistic story while you were gone, Dave, about the Mariners. He used all of the optimism in his body and wrote this story about why the Mariners have a really good shot this year.
Well, Dave.
He did not.
Yes, I did. They have a better shot than they would. Would you agree they have a better shot in a 60-game season than they would in a 162-game season?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. That was kind of my premise. Well,
you think of the first 15 games last year. I mean, that was really something special. Remember how much fun that was? That was fun.
Great.
Yeah.
Because you didn't expect it.
But they were 25-35 after 60 games. It didn't go well after the
Okay.
And 68-94.
My argument against that was just that because there is so much youth on this team that maybe it takes them a while to get going, get used to some of the pitching. You know, is Evan White going to come out of the gates hot? Is Shed Long going to be hot? You know, guys we haven't really seen do it. Is Jake Fraley going to be the starter out there? Is he going to adjust right away? Just the idea that these guys are going to start out hot. You tend to think with younger players, it takes them a bit to acclimate to this level. I know Shed Long's got a little bit more experience than the other guys I'm talking about, but, you know, you do have a very young team for the most part. It feels like that could work against a hot start.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, if you have a new pitching staff also, I mean, you know, a guy can come out and be a fireballer early on, and then all of a sudden batters, big league hitters will start lighting them up, and so could work the other way too. So, yeah, I mean, I guess I just automatically would take the under on that. And the only reason is because I honestly don't think it's about wins and losses this year. We all know, I mean, this is a team that's a couple of years away. So it's not about – I don't care if they win or lose. I think it's interesting. You said they were 25-35 last year, and now it's 25.5, right?
Right.
So they basically have gotten a half a game better, they think. So, you know, to me, I would take the under on that. That's just because, and I think it's just because that's just how I'm thinking. I'm like, I'm here this year just like everybody else to see the young talent develop, not here for wins and losses.
Do you think we're going to see the schedule release tomorrow, or do you think it'll be next week sometime? There's probably a lot of different things to figure out, but from what I understand, they're going to be playing – so the Mariners will be playing 10 games versus every AL West opponent, so that gives you 40 games. And then they figured out that they're going to have six games against the Padres probably, because they said it was every team's rival in the other league, and you know how the – it's a manufactured rivalry with the Padres.
It's not a rivalry.
But it's six games against the Padres is what I'm expecting. And then the other 14 games to get you to 60 are going to be against the Dodgers, Giants, Diamondbacks, and Rockies.
Yeah, the NL West.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm still wondering about their starting rotation. I mean, we know there's Marco. And Kikuchi, what's he going to be? He was a really big disappointment last year. I know he's going to be in there, but what do you expect from him? Justice Sheffield, a young guy, we'll see. Does he take the next step? Taiwan Walker, is he an automatic starter? Is he going to bounce back from his surgery? Who's their fifth starter? I don't even know who the fifth.
Kendall Graveman and Justin Dunn, if they're going to go with six.
Oh, okay.
That'd be my guess.
All right. So, I mean, you really, outside of Marco, you really have no idea what to expect out of any of these guys. They could be great. They could be lights out. But it's just a lot of unknown attached to a starting rotation where you've got really one truly proven commodity there in Marco Gonzalez and the rest. I mean, Kikuchi, maybe he finds it. Maybe he's short season. He's phenomenal. And Justice Sheffield, you know, just takes that large next step. And Taiwan Walker bounces back. But a lot of questions about that rotation.
Well, Bob, it sounds like you need to go back and reread my story.
Yeah. It was weird. It didn't convince me the first time.
That sounds all right. Torturous.
We'll come back. We'll talk some football. The professor, John Clayton, joins us next with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Wow, you sure know a lot of stuff.
It's great to learn,
because knowledge is power.
You know, we heard from some texters while we were gone that the collective IQ of the show went down without Dave Wyman here, which felt like a shot at Bumpus, but nobody takes shots at Bump, so I think maybe it was just a shot at me and Jim. But Dave is back, so I'm going to guess, Maura, that the learning has increased. Am I right?
Yeah, I think so.
Not necessarily.
Well, what did we learn, Maura?
Well, first off, we learned that Jim got busted for something he did while Dave was gone.
It's good to have you back, Dave. We really miss you. I was telling the listeners how the show just isn't the same without you, and so it's nice to have your presence
sure
back.
You did.
No, that's what I was saying yesterday, wasn't it, Bob? I told everyone how much we miss Dave and how it's going to be great to have him back tomorrow because, you know, the show without Dave Wyman just isn't quite the same.
Yeah, okay, so Rabel can walk away from Cairo TV, but there's no way that he can walk away from the Seahawks broadcast, because if he did, we'd be stuck with Wyman doing a solo job. Can you imagine Wyman doing play-by-play of the Seahawks games?
It finally came. Jim takes a shot at the vacationing Dave Wyman.
It'd be brutal.
You couldn't hold out.
It'd be brutal. I mean, he stumbles through his ads half the time, so yeah, imagine what he'd be like calling a Seahawks game. Yeah, he's not here, so, you know, so what? He's not for this.
Stumbles through his ads. Yeah, Dave Wyman, I guess you were ready for that, Dave. You're probably surprised he hadn't done it more often or been meaner.
Well, I would have been offended, which I'm never offended, if Jim had not made fun of me. No, I wouldn't have been offended. I would have just thought that there was something wrong, that maybe our relationship isn't as strong as it once was if Jim did not make fun of me. So,
well,
by the way, it...
Go ahead. No, go ahead, Dave.
I was going to say in my first year, 2018, we were in Chicago, which was the second game, and our producer, executive producer Brian O'Connell, comes up and says, hey, just so you know, we have a contingency plan if something happens to Rabel. You know, and basically, I think it was me calling the games, and I don't know if we're going to bring Clayton or have Mueller. You know, she's doing our sideline, so probably not, so... And I kind of froze up a little bit, like, whoa, wait, what do I do? How would I do that? What would that sound like? So anyway, that was kind of like, oh, man, I should probably practice at some point. Rabel, you know, Rabel's going to live to be like 112, so there's not going to be a problem.
Yeah. Well, guess what, Dave? Bob is going to be gone on Monday, so we'll have to scuffle our way through this.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah, one of you two is going to have to drive it, right?
Well, it'll be Dave.
Yeah. Well, Jim, you know who we have on Monday.
Who's that, Maura? Oh, I know. We have Michael Bumpus
Shannon
back.
Shannon Dreyer.
And Bumpus told me that he'd
Shannon Dreyer.
Oh, what, Shannon?
Yeah.
Oh, we're going to have Shannon?
Have to
wait,
nice.
Shannon's doing the show with us?
Yes.
The whole three hours?
Fantastic. Oh,
yeah, awesome. It's going to be a baseball-heavy show.
The whole 3 hours, Shannon's going to be with us.
Yes. Oh,
I might have
so
to call
nice.
In sick.
Hey.
Oh,
jeez. Come on.
Starting
already?
Off on the right foot.
I'm amusing myself here.
Stir some stuff up. Stir some stuff up.
I thought that was
Jim
funny. That wasn't funny?
I might have to record the show that day or go back and listen to the podcast to see 3 hours of tension between Jim and Shannon.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that'll be fun.
Well, maybe you can forward that emoji with the middle finger to Shannon so she can send that to Jim during the show.
What else did we learn, Maura?
We learned that the professor has a nickname for John Gruden.
Maura doesn't like to hear curse words. It offends him religiously to hear curse words. Well, what do you get out of John Gruden? Curse words. So it's like the Gruden dog's always going to be cursing, and that doesn't go well.
The Gruden dog. I have not heard anybody call him that.
I haven't either.
Well, neither has Clayton. And he said, yeah, I've been calling him that for you. That's the first time I've ever heard that. And we've talked about Gruden before. I've been talking to Clayton on the radio for 10 years. Oh, actually longer than that, 14 probably. Yeah. But, yeah, I think that he misremembered that. How about that?
Yeah, we've all brought up Gruden with him at one point or another. I was like, wait, did you just call him Gruden dog? What is that?
Yeah.
I like
love
it.
Clayton.
You like it, Maura?
Yeah, I think that's a good nickname.
All right. What else did we learn, M Dog?
We learned that Jim likes John Morosi because he doesn't believe in stupid questions.
John Paul, you're just the absolute best because, you know, any other guest might have said, "Man, that's a stupid question," and you called it an interesting question. So I appreciate that.
What's the truth? I call him like I see him, my friend.
You love him, right, Jim?
I do love him. Who do you think's more enthusiastic and optimistic about life, John Paul Morosi or Pete Carroll?
Pete Carroll.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. Yeah, that guy, you know what the thing he does is he calls you by your name. And I know I've not met John Paul, but I know that he knows Jim and he knows you run the show, Bob. And he called me Dave today. He'll call you Bob. And, of course, he knows Jim. Or do you know him from the past as well, Bob?
No, I don't. I think I may have met him once, but I don't know him. Not like Jim does.
I don't know. Yeah, but, I mean, it's just a nice thing to do, and it's just courteous, and, yeah, I can't get enough of that guy. I mean, there's no bad questions with him, and like you said, he's always enthusiastic, and what a nice guy. Send him a text, Mar, and tell him how much we love him.
Yeah.
I can do that.
He's great, but it's tough to top Pete. Everything's an opportunity. Everything's great. Injury ends the season. Another opportunity. It's pretty darn good. did we learn anything else, Maura?
Nope, that's all the learning we have time for today.
All right, there you go. I want to thank our guests, John Clayton, Andrew Brandt, and John Paul Morosi for joining us on the program. If you missed any of our show, just head to the podcast page at 710sports.com, click the podcast button, and click on our picture. It's all right there waiting for you. We're going to be back with you tomorrow right here with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.